Well, hello and welcome to Deacon Deconstructs, brand new podcast. This is the first one. And I'll be honest with you, I've been wanting to make this podcast for a long time. My career has pretty much been built around being a presenter and interviewing people. From the first moment, actually, thinking about it, was at university. First interview I ever did was with Colin Murray, just before he did a DJ set at my university. And then I interviewed Mr. Scruff, and I thought, hey, you know what? I like this thing, interviewing people and finding out their stories. And that's led me to work in BBC Switch, to Radio 1, to Copper 90, traveling the world, watching football and hosting there, to being on Capital, to having my own breakfast radio show, to being on joe.co.uk recently, to then hosting in esports. And all of those jobs have brought me to the point where I have to interview people and find out about them. And it's always fascinated me. So hey, this is what I'm doing. I thought, why don't I create something where I get to know people that little bit better, maybe break things down in their lives a little bit more in detail. And I guess that's why it's called Deconstructs. And throughout these podcasts, I want to bring interesting people to your attention. And I think it's a great way to start with someone I know and love very dearly. I've grown up with him and I've watched his career up close and from afar at times. And his name is Ryan O'Reilly. He's a singer-songwriter that you may have heard some of his music, and a lot of you probably won't have. But either way, I wanted to delve that little bit deeper into an area of his life, which is around about the time 2008, 2009, where he released his first EP called Emily. There's four tracks on it. And in this podcast, I'm going to ask them about those tracks and find out kind of the feelings behind them, and also reflectively looking back on it. And what you'll notice in this podcast, there's a theme around capturing a time and place and also creating your story. Those are themes that come across throughout. So listen, I hope you enjoy it. And I thought that would be quite nice to have a little twist. And that twist was I interviewed his sister, Kaylee, just before to find out and give you guys, I don't know, a kind of other side. When you interview people, they give it from their narrative and the way they see things. But it's quite nice to find someone who knows them very well and see what they think about everything. So, Kaylee, I just want to first of all check, is it going to be all right to talk about Ryan and Ryan's music career?
Historically, when I talk about Ryan, I normally get a kind of stop talking. but we'll see how it goes.
Why do you think you've always felt like he wants you to stop talking about his career?
Just because he says it. I remember once, I was at a party because, you know, obviously he's my older brother. So he was the one organising all the parties. And every now and again, me and my friends got to, like, you know, come along. I think if they needed to build up the numbers or something. And I was talking about his music and, you know, his journey through life. And I remember he said I was like a loud, nostalgic sea captain telling drunken stories at the time. So I'll try to rein that in today.
Listen, you do not need to rein it in on this show. I do want to know, though, was he always musical? What was he like when he was younger?
He was always kind of doing something. He had so much energy. And then my dad got him the guitar when he was about 10. I think that really kind of channeled the energy. Mm. I mean, he was the only musician in the house, but the house was always full of music.
Okay. All right. Well, that's good to know. Is it possible you could, I don't know, describe Ryan in three words?
Yeah, I think they kind of break the mold of Ryan. I don't quite know how you describe him. But yeah, definitely determined, really talented, but also very kind. I mean, the good thing about Ryan is if you need someone to tell you the truth or to give you some good bit of advice, he'll give that to you. He doesn't hold back. He doesn't always tell you what you want to hear, but he tells you what you need to hear. So yeah, and that's a good thing to have, I think.
You know, because when I think about Ryan, I see him as the narrator of lots of moments in my life with his music. You know, like every time he performs a song, it takes me right back to a memory. He's kind of like the storyteller. If he stops telling those stories, then I worry that I and other people who've had moments listening to his music will forget them.
Yeah, and actually, I think that sums up Brian perfectly. You asked me for three words: the storyteller. Yeah, he's an absolute storyteller. Yeah, it's so important, kind of keeping those memories alive, but also kind of pulling out what was important in those memories, the kind of things that you learn along the way. I think his music does that really well, at kind of pulling out, you know, you were drawn to that moment, and then the reflection kind of tells you why it was important.
You know what? I think I totally understand that, Kaylee. Well, listen, thank you so much for giving us an insight into Ryan. I think we better get straight to it and get him on the podcast. Right then, Ryan, let's take it all the way back to Emily, the EP. I believe that was around 2008 that you made that.
I think it's, well, 2008 is sort of the beginning of putting the train tracks down for that. I think we started recording in 2009, because I think in 2008 we were living together in London, so that would have still been university time. So this is, it's like being sort of amateur historians, but kind of we're debating the rise and fall of the Roman Empire or something. But it's 2008, yeah, was the end of my time at university. And then I think it was at the end of 2008 I moved into this like mad old coach house in the middle of Brixton, and it was like some sort of, it was such a find. It was such a weird little oasis, and amongst all these sort of tower blocks was this like otherworldly, like old worldy two-story coach house that kind of looked like it had been dropped there from another century. And that probably was late 2008. So we would have started recording in 2009, but we were there for a year. We only got like four songs sort of mixed and mastered, because you could record all you want, but like but we sort of didn't really have the money to take things all the way. You forget how much it costs to get things mixed and mastered properly and then printed up. So we were there for a year, we only got four songs done.
Yeah, the way you described that, it was literally dropped out of nowhere, your property that you
I hope
you had.
It's still there. I last time I saw it was about 6 years ago. I mean, I every time I walked past, I was like, some developer must be looking at this to demolish it and build like a ton of apartments. But it was such a, on Crownstone Lane, and it was full of mice and kind of such a strange building, but it was really unique.
I remember going round and you show me round, and I was like, why is there a pan on the floor upside down? And you were like, well, that stops the mice coming out of that hole. which I absolutely loved. And I was like, this is brilliant. Because to put it in context for everyone listening, when I met Ryan, I was like, oh, he's a musician. Okay, everyone's a musician. We've all watched Jack Johnson, excuse me, and his banana pancakes. Yeah, I know about this. And I'd watched you at open mics. But until that point, until the moment, sorry, that I'd seen you perform live, was the moment that I was just like, oh, this guy's for real. And I think that's the difference. I told you, yeah, I do comedy, but I'd never performed comedy before. And then we found out that the Candle Nightclub had a open mic and fascinating room. They had a actual traffic light to the side. When it was green, you were good to go. And you had about 7 or 8 minutes, then it would go amber.
So much pressure when it went to amber.
So much pressure, because you were like, oh no. And then you'd have 2 minutes left, and then it would hit red, and when it was red, it was time to leave. And I remember saying to you, well, why don't we go and perform, you know, this confident guy that I was, like, yeah, I've got this. And I think it was on the way there where I was writing down new material ideas, going, this will be fine, I'm funny, this is great. And I remember Mike, who I think did the artwork for your first album, he said I wouldn't do that joke.
It was amazing, like the timing of it. I remember us driving down in the car, and I think Mike was driving, and you like pitched a joke, and he was just like, nah,
don't do that. So I lost all confidence. And here's the magical thing, I invited everyone I knew, girlfriend at the time, her mum came down as well.
Oh, like, my god, I forgot about that.
I had everyone down there, and I was like, and everyone was like, because I'd always talked about it, like, yeah, I want to do stand-up comedy, there's nothing else I want to do. And then you went, do you want me to go on first? And I went, yeah, yeah. Because I was still thinking in my head, he'll crash and burn here. And then I'll just come up on stage and it'll be perfect. And I just remember it. And obviously, you remember things, not rose-tinted glass, but you remember it slightly differently. It's more of a feeling. And the feeling that I had then was, oh, shit. This guy is got that something. And he's performing. And the whole room was in your world. And
then, I think it's hard though to compare, like I still think comedy and music, it's like you need such a engaged and kind of comedy literate audience to sort of interact with you, whereas music, like, you know, people can actively participate obviously, and but they can passively participate as well, so it's like I think it's easier to, you know, I'm giving you get out of jail free card here, Tom. Like, it's easier to like go up and like wow an audience with like a song than it is to sort of, especially an open mic night when you got like hardly any time to establish a rapport. Comedy's a bit of a it's a tricky one. Multi art nights where it's like comedy and poetry and music. I think they tend to favour the musicians because people can sort of, you know, listen at the back of their brains rather than have to sort of
engage fully. Engage. But here's the thing, just so everyone understands the full story, I was one of the passive watchers because I was at the back going, he's really good. This is annoying. What am I going to do? And it was not a competition, but I was like, the room to me was quiet to listen to you, and you'd cry, you know, and that's the beauty of watching you perform. You'd manage to just make them all pay attention, and that's half the battle, like you say. And I was at the back thinking, I can't do this. And it's the only time I have ever not gone on stage. Sure, I've been nervous over the years, but that was the, and I think you have to go through those moments where I actively went round to people who'd come specifically to see me, and the shame that I felt of having to tell them I'm not going to go on, and they've made all the effort to come down, and you smashed it, and you came off like with such a big smile, and you were like, oh mate, I can't wait to watch you. Are you up next?
I can. It's such an interesting moment in your. It's like, it's really interesting that's your like first performance, but. I mean, it's good in a way that's your first performance and not like 100 shows in that you were like, I can't go on this stage. It's like the first one was a hard one, but yeah.
But it's sort of, and I think people have to understand, like, you, that's how you, the ability you had to get people's attention at these open mic nights and moving to London, and that's something you did, and you almost then had to learn completely again how to be on your own and get people's attention. And I think that's why it's so iconic when you went to Portobello Road to perform, that you were able to grab the crowd. What do you remember, like, how did that transition period to become like a busker in many respects? You were there busking, telling the world about your songs, and you were able to then be able to go back and have enough money to then be able to record and produce the EP Emily. So let's kind of get back onto that track of that process. You moved to Brixton. Well, how did you start making it?
It's funny because when you go from open mic nights and you got like three songs, and maybe you learn those three, or, you know, you have a small repertoire of maybe one or two originals. I think I have one or two originals and a few covers. But you're still, like, I think when you're sort of 16, 17, 18, like, for me, I was still imitating. I was still trying to be somebody that I wasn't yet, but some, like, trying to project in that kind of fake it till you make it type way. But then when you kind of, when you leave home, you finish college, and you say, right, this is what I do now, then your sets get longer. The things that you kind of ride over as, like, you know, your own experience, and people will give you the benefit of the doubt, suddenly you gotta get better at everything. You like, especially for me, I think it was the talking in between songs was like an important thing, and that was interesting, obviously, like when we lived together and watching so much comedy, seeing how comedians can really be so just free without a guitar. Like for me, the guitar, like I was hiding behind the guitar. I think I was, you know, somewhere between this sort of extrovert and introvert. Like I was proud of the songs, but I was shy of like those silences between the songs. So I had to get better at that. And but there was something really being thrown into the fire with street performing, because when we moved to this place in Brixton, it was like too expensive for us really to be living in, and we had no money, and we said, oh, we'll go street performing, but we would show up hungover and without our instruments like properly tuned, and we would make a little bit, and then the next time we'd take it a little bit more seriously, and like we'd make a little bit more money. But it wasn't until I started thinking of it as an art form within itself, like, you know, where I sort of grew up, and near to where you grew up in Winchester, we have that tradition of the hat fair, and I think it's mentioned in like Chaucer, you know, it goes back to the Middle Ages, that idea of the street performer gathering around the village and doing something, and you could really see them. It was like the last August of the last weekend of every August, they'd have the hat fair, and you could see it wasn't really musicians, it was often like jugglers or people on unicycles or something, but they were really funny in between their sets. Mm. And they really led you on this really interesting journey that it was about them making money, but it was about you having an experience, and the two, like, it was just a win-win situation. You know, they made money and the audience was entertained, and no one was being conned or sort of or anything. And I sort of remembered that, and I saw it again when you get to places like Covent Garden, and I thought, I want to take a little bit of that and put that into sort of this musical street performing that we're doing. And I don't want to be like a busker playing covers. Not that there's anything wrong with that. It's a hard slog, but I wanted to look like a band who happened to be street performing, that it was kind of an accident. It was a one-off. It was an excitement. When you could harness the sort of excitement of the event, then you could really feel like an electricity in the air. And it really grew over like 2009 into 2010. And we were street performing every weekend, and we started to make more and more money. And eventually it just became enough that we could put it into things like recording. And with the Emily EP, we were recording at home, and the producer I've worked with on everything for the last 10 or 12 years, Dave Granshaw, he came up from the Isle of Wight and basically built a studio by hand into this weird old coach house that we were living in. And then it was, you know, it was something that that just grew very organically. I kind of wish I knew, like, I wish I could say that it had been planned, or it had been that I'd sort of strategized it this way, but it all just sort of grew out of necessity and happy accidents and a few unhappy accidents. And and then by the end of that, we had these sort of, we had these four songs that no one was, like, in the industry wise was going to hear. And I was a bit naive to think that I knew, you know, how those things added up, that a manager would come along, and then we'd get signed to a label, and then agents would put us on the road, and those things would happen sort of step by step. But what actually happened was the CD got out there because of street performing. So it was, and the people that discovered it became fiercely loyal to it, in a way that even when I did have those things of like a label and agents and managers, people, I don't think anything quite captured the loyalty that people felt about discovering a band themselves. It's like, it's their decision to like my music, our music. It was their decision to buy that CD and to take it home. And I think that it represents for a lot of people like a time in their lives, which is sort of important. That, you know, it's my music, but I'm kind of just a part of their story. Like, whether, you know, when you're a Spanish tourist with your boyfriend or your girlfriend on this like first trip to London, and you discover this street performing band, and you buy a CD that they've made themselves, and you take it home, and it's maybe better than you expected a street performing band CD to be, then you feel like you've made that decision. You've sort of created something culturally in your life. You've made this space for your sort of memories to sit. And that was the journey, really.
Beautifully there. Because I think that's the thing. I should come clean. I did interview your sister before this interview, Ryan.
Really? That's funny.
And she did say to me, she said that you're a storyteller. That's probably the best way to describe you. And that way that every music, like the four tracks of Emily, people would take that away, that's a story in their life now, like you're saying. And when you perform these albums, they're parts of your life, but also parts of many other people's lives. It reminds them of this moment that they were going through or that. So you are then therefore you're the guy that has to continue to tell these stories. Otherwise those stories get forgotten.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's important. I mean, storytelling is, sorry, my cat's going absolutely mad. She's got something she wants to say. I don't know, it's probably that she wants to go outside. Storytelling has always been kind of the most important thing to me. Like, my degree was in literature, not in music, and my sort of ethos on life is very much about chapters, and that you know, sometimes it feels like life is being written by some sort of unseen author, and you're sort of playing that part. And I think those years, especially after university, when you're sort of finding your way in the world, that they're an important time to make your own story. And you got a little bit more toughness to sort of fight through, to fight through some of the hardships and create your story. And that's certainly what we did back then.
You know what, Ryan? I asked your sister, I said, what made the Ryan O'Reilly Band so magical at the time that they were performing on Portobello Road?
The fact it was so authentic and they were having so much fun doing it. I think there was this kind of energy that they were a group of people you wanted to go to the pub with them afterwards. You know, I think a lot of people were drawn to them in the sense that they were a band having fun, making some really beautiful original music, and people wanted to be part of that. They wanted to kind of be with the band. They were really good at chatting. You know, there's really nice kind of banter amongst themselves, but also with the people kind of walking by. And I think it was the kind of the way of life as well as the music that people were attracted to.
So basically, she said there that you're authentic. You looked like you were having fun doing it. It was original music. People wanted to be with the band. The fact that they might want to go and have a beer with you afterwards. There was that energy about Portobello Road. Do you think that your songs on the EP, Emily, November, The Morning, John Keats, do you think, because she describes how the audience would affect how you performed the songs, and the songs would affect how the audience would respond to them. So it was a kind of every time you'd watch you perform, it was kind of different. Even though it was the same songs you performed, it was, you were feeding off the audience as much as they were feeding off you.
Yeah, it's funny with that, because I definitely performed, like, sounds weird to say I performed to the audience, but in a way I sacrificed some sort of like dynamism, dynamics of the songs themselves. Everything was at 11. It was kind of the subtleties were diminished in order to put on the show, and the show was like sort of a 7-song blast of a set, and it was important to just connect immediately. And that's the thing you learn with street performing, is that you've got like 3 seconds for people to make up their mind, whereas, you know, if they're listening to you on Spotify or something, then they can take their time, put it on the background, return to it. But when you're street performing, you've just got that one tiny window where someone's got to decide if they're going to part with their money. And then even then they kind of might take your CD home and not listen to it again for like 3 months. But it was certainly something about grabbing people's attention that you learn street performing. I think street performing is like working in a bar. Everybody should do it like once to see what you're made of, see, like give you a bit of toughness, a bit of mental toughness. And also, you know, it was important to know when it was time to move on from that. I'm a bit like university. I'm glad I did it, but I wouldn't do it again.
No. I definitely agree with that. I mean, the madness at the time that you're talking about, I was away in a world of presenting. You know, I was presenting on a BBC Switch, it was called, show, and that
I remember,
led to Radio 1, which then led to me talking to Hugh Stevens. And I remember giving him the Emily EP. I remember handing it to him.
Wow. And thanks for doing that. he don't remember getting invited onto Radio 1, but still, thanks for doing that.
But anytime. But that, you see, that was the real interesting thing, because I was moving into this world of music, and I was like, you've got to listen to this, Hugh. Hugh Stevens was all about, you know, the music, the bands that weren't getting all of the PR that that was the essence of his show. It was about, mm-hmm. This is a great band I saw in Brighton the other weekend. And so I gave him the EP, and he said he really, really enjoyed it. And once I'd explained, like, you know, down at Portobello Road, they do this, they're brilliant, you should see them live, they're great. You know, and because I did that because I believed in your music and I enjoyed it and I wanted other people to experience it. I think that's always the way that you can say to someone, you should see this musician, but it's not for me, and you might disagree, but once you see your set performed live, people fall in love with what you're doing. It's almost, not to say that it doesn't transfer on an EP, but seeing you live, unashamedly, I'd say, you get to really feel all of that emotion, that ability you have on stage.
Well, that's the hard thing to translate that then onto record. If you because some of that sort of dynamism and musicality was sacrificed on Portobello Road in place of energy and passion, and you know, you can't be doing intricate finger picks. You got to be smashing your guitar, but like you're singing these harmonies and it feels like you know, something from somewhere between the band, like The Last Waltz, kind of everyone coked up, and Van Morrison kicking his feet around the stage, and a campfire. So it's like but you maybe then, well, certainly for me, I had sacrificed some musicality, that when I got into the studio, it was hard to kind of marry those two. And I was lucky, I had good musicians around me, but we spent lots of time navigating songs to try and do recorded versions. That it's very hard, like it's kind of, sometimes it feels quite easy to say, I like this live, you should record this as it was live, but you don't have an audience in front of you, and the studio is a very, you know, the sound is very dead for a reason, so that it can be sort of mixed and all these things can happen to it afterwards. And if you try to do just like a live sounding thing in the studio, very often all the sounds are bouncing around, and whoever's mixing it, mastering it, producing it has a nightmare to make it sound listenable. Like, you know, anytime we said, oh, we'll all just play in the room like we do on Portobello Road, it sounded better in our heads than it did when we sort of would listen back to it afterwards. And So that was the thing. It was hard. I mean, the most popular song we ever did on Portobello Road and on all the live records was called November. But on the Emily EP, it was the first time we tried to be a bit more mature about it and tried to sort of put in intricate finger-picking patterns and more dynamics and sort of background sounds. And it wasn't, I think, as universally loved as the live recordings were.
Normally in interviews, you sort of think to yourself, okay, tell me, who is Emily? What is Emily about? But when you look back, and you're going to be performing this on May the 2nd, but the brief synopsis of what Emily is about.
Well, Emily was an interesting one because, and I'm always a bit torn about describing songs. I remember watching one of those classic albums sort of documentaries about
Does it ruin the magic for you, I guess?
Well, a little bit. I was like, well, it can do. Not so much for me, is that I'm worried that somebody has in their mind that says, oh, I know what this means, and I think I know what the songwriter's relationship to that song is. And then I remember listening to like the classic album Paul Simon's Graceland, and that line, my traveling companion is 9 years old, he's the child of my first marriage. And I also, such an amazing line, and kind of picturing his life. And then the documentary says, yeah, I just thought that was a cool line. Like, that's really annoying. I wish you hadn't said that. But
okay then.
Having said that, the thing is, I don't know if this is interesting, so I'll tell it anyway, that the time we were all living in Brixton, we had a piano player named Brad, and very talented guy, but he was sort of on the verge of leaving the band. He had a few things going on in his life. One weekend he went home and he just never sort of came back. We had a bunch of shows that he didn't show up for, so it was a bit of a hassle. But he was funny, sarcastic, kind of intimidating in his talent, but and a big drinker. He'd drink any of us under the table, but he always kind of he made about one comment too many about his status as a musician above mine as a singer songwriter sort of guitar player, that, you know, that's kind of a garden variety common route, whereas like being a sort of concert level pianist was a lot more special. And I understand a lot of that, and actually, you know, there's a good argument to be made there, but on that particular day I wasn't going to have any of it. So I, you know, he'd never really written any songs, and a lot of people don't know what it's like to write these types of songs that are like, how I write songs is somewhere between a like a detective searching for a you know, interviewing a suspect and a psychotherapist. It's like, and sometimes I do that to myself, but sometimes if I write with somebody that I'm close to, I do that with them. So we did that. We had this weird little kind of lobby area behind the big green doors, and I had my Vespa parked up on these cobblestones that was in this like weird half, it felt like it was outdoors, but it was actually indoors. And we had an upright piano that we just brought around from some old lady's house. And I sat on my moped, and me and Brad got really drunk, and I showed him how I write songs. So I said, well, you know, tell me about this girl that, like, the last girl that meant something to you. And he said, well, you know, her name was Emily. And I was like, all right, I want 5 pages of details about the last time you saw her. And every time it would try and go into like generalizations or something too wide lens, I said, no, I want the smallest details, because within those details that you choose to reveal will be, you know, hints at sort of the larger theme. And as he would talk, I would just circle the phrases that I liked. So he would say, well, you know, she was leaving, but she'd broken this thing, and I was trying to fix it. And I said, look, you know, you got to go. I'll stay behind and fix this. And I kind of liked, you know, I thought that there was a lot of metaphor in that. And said about that she had some sort of like hand hands that were painted on the wall from her and her friends. And I was like, oh, that's kind of interesting imagery. And he just said as an aside that, he bumps into her brother in the pub and it's always embarrassing. So I kind of got all that down. And then the sort of the past then mixed up with the present, that as we were getting progressively drunk, a bottle smashed in the sink in this weird little lobby bit that we had, and Brad cut his hand, and I kind of liked the idea that he was a pathetic mess without her. And so that became like the second verse of being like, you know, if you were here, I wouldn't be up at 4 o'clock in the morning in Brixton with bloody hands getting completely smashed while you could hear like the drug dealers outside. And yeah, it was a fun exercise, but it kind of came from a bit of a vindictive place. I wanted to show that that it was hard, and I wanted to make him cry, and I did, and that was important for me. And it was important that, you know, that these songs are like that they hurt the person that it comes from, and it hurts the person that it's about, because otherwise it's not going to hurt the listener that, you know, that wants to be hurt in that kind of nice melancholic way, that you want to be hurt a little bit by a song about a breakup. So it was like an important exercise, and it was something that's maybe I didn't realize it would be so enduring. I think it was kind of right time and right place, and it was the last thing that Brad ever played on as well. So you on the record you can hear his piano playing, and he sort of disappeared from our lives shortly after that, and never saw him again. So I was lucky to get that song out of him before he left.
The last day that you were mine, you were leaving in your dad's car, Emily. And you were trying to fix something you had just broken. I said, if you need to go, you can leave this with me. I stared at the handprints on your bedroom wall. They're ready like mine to keep you safe from it all. Your brother came home early, he found me crying. It's embarrassing now when we meet at the bar. And the towns and lights and the arrivals board rearrange above the place where you used to wait for me. But nobody searches for my face in the crowd since the day you left me, Emily. It's 4 in the morning.
It, to me, it's always kind of like an upbeat sort of song, especially with the piano, and then when you move into November, that's a bit of a gear change. Live, very different. Mm-hmm. What was your thinking on how you created this version of November?
Well, we were just the hardest thing is recording songs that have a past, because they're sort of have a lot of different fingerprints on them, and when you're in the studio, you kind of always want to create something new. So it's very hard to create something new from something that's old. So even though November was only about a year and a half old by the time we were in Brixton, it had already become sort of like, you know, our most popular song. And we'd done a kind of a rowdy live album in the Half Moon in Putney. And that had been popular, even though it was like very ramshackle and you know, slightly out of tune and out of time and everything, but it was the first thing that we sold street performing, and the version of November on that was widely loved by the people that were buying it. So when we approached it again to record it, we were thinking things like, oh, we want this to be on the radio, and we want this to get, like, you know, picked up and put in the film or something, and we had people asking about it, but I think we were being a little bit ambitious for our means and our abilities, and we were trying to be clever with a song that already had a past and a footprint. So we kind of deconstructed it and we put it back together, and like the things that are on it is I think are interesting. Like we put a horn section in the chorus, which can sound a bit cliche, but actually, like, you know, we weren't just throwing any horns on. We were picking like euphoniums and French horns, and the parts were sort of carefully thought out. But whether it was right for the song or not But beside the point, I mean, we struggled with that song over and over again because it was, you got a small window really to capture a song, and an album or recording, an EP, whatever. Really, you know, I think I knew that at the time, but I know that even more now. It's about capturing a time and a place. It's not really about capturing a song so much. Like so Emily was written in Brixton, and we recorded it in Brixton, and it worked perfectly. It had no fingerprint or past. It was just, that is the way the song is. November was already a challenge because it had an identity.
That I was waiting for, bus in northeast London late last night. It was November and I had so far to go. I was awoken by the aircraft in this melancholic weather, and your distant cracking voice telling me to let this whole thing go. I hear the beating, pounding rhythms of the wristwatch that I'd wear. I thought I'd grown adolescence nor escape my first gray hair. She knows this band just got signed and tore all the time. Asked her how she thinks I'm doing, and she said it feels just fine. But you'll never change the world when your song's your guitar. When people have your age, they're going twice as far. Everybody wants me, but I'm tied right down to you. When I finally go under, you know that I'll drink too.
In terms of like a little bit of reflection, I mean, it's what your sister said so well about you, Ryan. You're keeping those memories, you're pulling out what you've learned and drawn on, and it's the reflection that tells you why it was important. It's a beautiful way she summarizes you as a storyteller. So reflecting on it now, when you move into that second song, November, would you do things differently with that EP, or do you not look at EPs in that way, or you would, that is what it was?
I think even, you know, perceived missteps on records are kind of just as important as anything else. Like, you know, it's the song, I think, you know, the song still stands up, and we just try to address it a slightly different way. I said, well, we struggle with that. Even when years later, when I signed a proper deal, and part of the deal was that we had to record November because, oh, you know, from the record company's point of view, it was the most popular song. Why wouldn't we record that? Because as far as they were concerned, the people that had heard it, it was a very small number, and they wanted to reach to a larger number. And that, you know, we had the chance to do it again. And we had exactly the same struggle. It was not any easier 7 years after this time. It wasn't any easier getting in the studio and saying, right, we've got to approach November again. But really, you've got, I don't know, a year to record a song, I think. So, I don't know, we learned a bit about that, but I'm still learning the same lesson over and over again.
But, it repeats itself sometimes. Yeah. Well, what about? But I think that's a beautifully put. You learn from it, and you can look back on it. And hey, do you know, more than anything, gives you something to talk about on that EP.
Well, November is a hard one anyway because it's such a range of emotions. So I can understand why it's hard to capture in a studio, because when I'm looking at an audience and singing it, like you go from this kind of like almost like wistful defeatism to like anger, self-pity, jealousy, all these things. It's a strange thing to do that sort of alone in a studio. But I sometimes think there was an album that didn't get captured maybe like a year before we recorded Emily. If we'd met the right producer, maybe just as soon as we moved into Brixton, would have been interesting to have been guided through an album, like if we'd had a bit of money and a bit of backing. But then, you know, then we wouldn't have had the story that we did, and we wouldn't have had to have gone street performing. Mm. And actually, perversely, we wouldn't have made nearly as many fans, because it was the fact that we had no backing and no money meant that we had to go street performing, which is what gave me the fan base in the first place. So it's a weird paradox, really.
Yeah, it had to work the way it did. That's the beauty of it. But what about the morning then? Because I know I asked your sister favorite track on the album, and that's John Keats. So we'll find out what she thought about it. But what about the morning?
The morning I wrote, actually I wrote that a little bit before as well, but we hadn't sort of done as much with that, so it still felt a bit fresher. And I wrote that when we were living together, Tom. I remember, I think I started that in the living room, in amongst all the games of Pro Evo or FIFA, whatever it was being played at the time.
Halo as well. We had housemate, Dave, who, although my Xbox didn't matter, Dave was the main occupier of that. because I'd at this point been signed by a comedy agency, Avalon. I was like, where are the gigs that pay me money? And they said, well, there aren't any, so I suggest you get a job. That's exactly how it was spelt to me by my manager. Yeah. And so that's it. I went and worked in a hotel. So that meant I left at about half five in the morning to get a bus.
Yeah, I remember you getting the bus at 5 in the morning from East Sheen, where we lived.
Yeah, to then get the bus to Hammersmith, to then get on the tube, to get to Green Park, to then walk down.
What a nightmare journey.
But you know what? I remember once I did finally get booked for Cardiff University, and I was on with, who was I? I know that for a fact I was on once with Chris Ramsey and Roisin Conaty, great lineup. And I got there and I said, what time does the gig start? And it said on my little email, confirmation contract, that it started at 8:30. And I was like, well, that's perfect because it will be finished by 9. I'll be back on the train. The last train back from Cardiff to London is 9:25. And I have to get up at 5:30 again to go to work. And I got to the gig and they said, oh, no birds. It doesn't start till about 9. And I went, well, tonight it needs to start at 8:30 because I need to get this last train. And we managed to do it. So it started at 8:50. And I was in a taxi and managed to get back and my main concern was, how am I going to get to my hotel job tomorrow? But it should have been. And times I've learned that the focus should have been 100% on the gig, but then it was the last train and I didn't have any accommodation. So I was almost like, I have to be quite militant about how I set my time out. I've got a commitment here and I've got a commitment to the gig. The gig was good, but I was stressing about, you know, how I'd get home. So it was kind of an admin sort of time. But yes, in that time, I didn't get to play Xbox as much as I would have liked to, is all I was trying to say. Because I was busy trying to make enough money to live on and start my comedy career.
You're disciplined with that. I've lost many a job by just staying in bed or staying up too late or something. I remember just one day when I was tour guiding and I just looked out the window at the rain and I thought about the traffic and thought about my hangover and I just switched my phone off and never went back to that job. So you're very, very good and disciplined.
So you wrote this morning, the morning in the lounge that we lived in.
Yeah. And I guess that was a bit like, there was a few songs coming through that were, felt like they were a bit more my voice that I was saying a bit before, that you know, when you start off, like when you're playing the open mic nights when you're a teenager, you're trying to imitate other people, but the morning had a bit more they were sort of abstract details of real things that had happened or were happening, but the song was a bit more ambiguous than something like November, which was very like to the point. This one was a bit more dreamlike, and more maybe open to interpretation, but it's in this kind of waltz and it's and it has a bit more of like an Irish lilt to it, so it fit really well in a set. And I can see, you know, it was maybe not like the number one song that we had with fans, but it was certainly in the top sort of 5 or 6 that people would ask for. So it was fun to approach that one. And I think we did an interesting job with that. Spencer, who just started playing with us at that time, he came up with this really beautiful pick on the Spanish guitar, and there's pedal steel, which was his main instrument, and we had mellotron on there, this like beautiful flute sounding mellotron, and that was maybe one of the Emily kind of came together really easily. November we struggled with, but the morning was a nice one where it was thought about and it was really carefully arranged and it came together well. So it was like in between those two.
Lifeboats of sunshine and oceans of shade, and the children dance on the promenade. You're drowning in vodka and lemonade. You hold on to me when you are afraid. And I met you in the dinner hall. I was dressed like a soldier, smart and tall. You in your dress against the wall said this is not what I wanted at all. So good night, see you in the morning. The lights went out.
A snippet of that played, and that's the third track on the EP. So we move into the fourth on the EP, and that's John Keats, which I'm not. Am I right in thinking this one's going to be the trickiest one for you to get together to ready to perform live again?
No, actually, I don't think so, because there is like a sort of an acoustic way of playing that. That's another one. I'm not entirely sure we quite got the right arrangement on the EP, but we came very close. There's like, that one's ambitious with like this very sparse piano that sort of then doubles up on itself, and there's a lot of space, which is quite mature really for how young we were. And in a way it was almost like we were maybe trying to be too mature, but that song had been around for a year as well, I think, at that stage. And I'd written that when I was 22, but like I think it was the day before my 23rd birthday, and it was the final year at university in Roehampton, and we'd had a bit of like there'd been a bit of rocky things going on, a few like, you know, growing up quick moments, and I was thinking about John Keats, because he died early. Obviously, he was, you know, as it says in the song, he was 25 when he died, and I sort of come face to face with an early death on campus, and that's what kind of got me thinking about that. And then you start having that, what was I call now, like a quarter life crisis of, you know, when you get to like 23, you feel like maybe you should be kind of touching down onto the path that you're going to be on, and you know, if you start kind of questioning yourself and say, well, should I already be there? Should I be on this path? Where should I be? And you know, that never really changes, but I think I was feeling it particularly keenly on the eve of my 23rd birthday. And it was funny, I was on tour the end of last year with a girl from Boston, and we were on tour in Sweden, and it was her 23rd birthday, and I was 33, so I'm 10 years older than her. And the song also mentions kind of projecting is like, you know, 33 is mentioned as another sort of important age. I thought it was funny. I played the song that night as this sort of weird,
stars aligning kind
scenario.
Of.
Yeah, stars aligning. Like I'm on stage with a 23-year-old. I'm 33, singing a song I wrote when I was 23, imagining being 33.
And there you are in that one moment. As I mentioned before, this is your sister's favorite song, and this is what she says about it.
That's such a beautiful, important song. There's so many kind of wonderful lines in there. But I think it really, it summarizes that kind of, that knowledge that life is kind of fleeting, and that struggle to kind of make your mark and the kind of the beauty of the struggle. Although I did have a housemate called Emily at the time, he thought Emily was the best song, so that also got played a lot.
I've got a copy of Catcher in the Rye in my top pocket. I think you know why. So order me something from the dusty top shelf. I can't keep my secrets in, nor my hands to myself. So we put on those old records, drank spirits with my friends. But not long ago, I could never know, like you turn a page, some words.
So there you go, four tracks from Emily, the EP, which definitely shows the journey, the story that, that sort of played out. And the things, I guess, that we all do in our careers is look back and think, I might have done this differently. But then again, it wouldn't have got me X, Y, and Z.
Yeah, that's the thing, yeah.
Seeing you perform, I think it was Christmas time back in Winchester, and you had a set list, you put it together. And that's kind of interesting why you'd play a song, choose one song over another. But with this opportunity now to play the album in full, in its entirety, that must be quite an interesting creative challenge to do now, because you wrote it, as you said, 10 years ago, more than that. What's it like to then suddenly play it again?
Well, it's funny with this time and, you know, being sort of confined to doing live streams and everything. When I was discussing with Paul and Jay from Boom Boom Zoom about all this at the start of, like, you know, people realizing that we're in a pandemic and we're in a lockdown, and art as we know it is going to change. And, like, you know yourself that a big thing of performing, like what gives a show its sort of uniqueness when you're on a tour isn't necessarily the material, because you might be playing the same material each night, but it's the changing audience, the changing location. You know, is an audience in Glasgow different to an audience in Exeter? As you know, you do that tour and the venue changes, the feel of where you are changes. If you haven't got that anymore, like, where does the sort of uniqueness come from, and why should somebody, you know, you could play 30 shows on a tour, but, like, why would you do 30 live streams of the same show? It's kind of incomprehensible that you would do that, really. So you want to give them a theme and an identity. And, you know, we're at a time that I like looking forward. It's very easy to get nostalgic and to look back, and there's that sort of Glory Years song by Bruce Springsteen about the folly of being that guy that looks back on his glory years. And, you know, it's you do want to be going forward and making new material and everything, but we're in a situation now, and for us who are artists who pay our bills this way, it's like a way to give something an identity, and then sort of be forced to look back and say, well, I'm not doing this necessarily out of choice, but now that I am doing this, it's interesting to sort of think about the context of those songs, why I wrote them, how I wrote them, and how people feel about them sort of this long away from the recording and the writing. And, you know, it's interesting going back to sort of Portobello Road and how people discover this EP or Live at a Half Moon or The Blighted Apple. It's like how their relationship with it has changed, because now that was 10 years ago, they might be married with children, and this EP, this song, one song from the EP might remind them of when they were 17 and at the end of college and on a school trip with their friends, and they happened to see some buskers on Portobello Road, and they brought this CD back. So it's interesting for me to look back, but hopefully it's interesting for the audience who tune in on May the 2nd to look back as well, because you know, it'll be just as much their journey as mine. So that's kind of the nice thing about being retrospective, being forced to be retrospective right now.
Well, listen, thank you very much, Ryan. Great to have you on the podcast, the first ever one of Deacon Deconstructs. I think we've started with a brilliant guest. We really delved in deep into a particular time in his life, and that EP, Emily. I'll be back very shortly with another Deacon Deconstructs. I was going to call it Tom Talks, but someone's already got that on YouTube. But anyway, that's aside from the point here. If you haven't already done so, go and check out his music. It's on Spotify. Check him out on his Instagram, on Twitter. There's some beautiful music. That's just the tip of the iceberg. So go and check that out. In the meantime, stay safe, and I'll catch you again on another podcast. All right. Goodbye.